Chapter 10, Voodoo Slaves for the Devil's Daughter. She found me reading Spark of the Grey Fees. The words were often familiar, but the language itself a mystery, dependent on many secondary, even primary references, denied my limited intelligence and experience. But gradually I came to learn the rudiments of a kind of second ether pigeon, until I grew skillful enough to enter into bond with my character, and add her considerable store of wisdom to my own. Suddenly I knew the powers and near omniscience of a demigod. "I have never seen a man so hungry for the second ether," she said. "My name is Sam Oakenhurst. I am of the Ugador persuasion. Mercy Marie, and until I met my love, the Rose, followed that calling in the first ether, until after several adventures I joined the Rose to play the ultimate game, the Zeitwege, the game of time, which I shall continue to play for the rest of my long life, for I have by unhappy accident joined the ranks of the dying." As soon as we were first reunited and alone, we embraced. In my fever I had confused her with Pearl Peru. It was as if everything I had ever valued or desired was at once restored to me. Spark of the Grey Fees tells this tale the best, with all the nuances, the moral ambiguities, the odd twists of plot common to the old, finest old V's of the Golden Age. It is a terrifying thing to have to accept one reality in the favour of the others. It is that moment of choosing which is so distressing. Extinction or eternal life on the throw of a die. And in the end, the game of time engulfed me. I was addicted, as I had told her I would be, as she never wanted me to be. "Our black little soul, Sam," she had said. "That's all we have between us and the pit. But it's enough to give us even gods and even odds, in a game which, if you lose, you will live a billion glorious years or more, and if you win, you live forever. Either way, Sam, suit yourself. You'll discover what you want in the second ether. And it's only rarely, muy compañero, that you find what you expected to find. Have you anything to lose by playing the big table, Sam? Playing for the power to change the nature of reality? That's what it means when you control time." She pressed her warm rose lips against my hard, fleshless head. "We're playing against entropy and for chaos, against singularity and for law, for life against death. We're playing for the power to change the human condition." As the meaning of her words threaded into the dark places of my imagination, I experienced the kind of fear which had seized me when the Mashima first began their indoctrination rituals with the gentle scarrings. But now I knew one thing I had not known then. I would survive, and I would profit from the experience. That, I realized, was why the Rose had chosen me as her consort at this level of the game. I feared neither pain nor death, but only the loss of my love and my honour, and for those alone I was prepared to play to the end. I lie. I did not fear pain. I embraced it. Pain was my positive proof that I lived. Chapter 11, Fear Asa. The Machinois cleared their way past New Orleans, and provisions were waiting for them on the quays, tended by whiteys in their master's intricate tattooed livery, who efficiently stowed the goods and offered themselves as hands if needed. Rose von Beck in particular was reluctant to have these strange creatures aboard. They appeared completely dedicated to the well-being of the Machinois, yet seemingly had their own customs and codes independent of their master's. Only Sam Oakenhurst could explain the Machinois, and he never spoke of his kindred, as if to reveal anything of them would be a betrayal. Sam Oakenhurst was casual with the whiteys, showing them a kind of veneration. The few he recognised, he asked after cousins and aunts. To his companions, he argued that a couple would be useful, since nobody had any idea anymore what was going on beyond St. Louis. These whiteys at least wouldn't desert. At first, Jack Caraquazian supported the Rose. Eventually, however, Mr. Oakenhurst persuaded them to take four as stokers. The Rose had explained the existence of the second ether and how the game of time was played in it, a story created by the Chaos Engineers and the Singularity, but affecting all existence, as well as the fate of every individual and quasi-individual. In the Zeitzweigo, one joined one's identity with that of an existing player. By adding one's talents to the whole, one played for an advantage in the story, perhaps making a new character or developing a fresh plot thread, perhaps a beginning, a fresh echo to fill a void and set new patterns working, perhaps even adding to their pantheon. She had told Jack that, whether he played the game or not, he would certainly be reunited with Kalinda Devero in the second ether. "What are they, these chaos engineers and their opponents?" asked Jack. "Our creations?" "It's not as simple as that, Jack," murmured Sam. "But we play for chaos. We play on the side of our own advantage, sometimes for theirs. It is an acceptable symbiosis." "Well, how is that?" The Rose explained how the symbiosis became complete until there was no escaping the character or the game. One played perpetually until one's dissolution. All characters were controlled by the laws of entropy. Ultimately, they would die, their souls with them. What the Rose and her kind played for was a chance to defeat the laws of entropy and create nothing less than a new reality. To mould the multiverse in our own image. To Jack Caraquazian, that sounded very much like blasphemy. To find a way of living in the multiverse according to natural laws. The triumph of life over death. The triumph, Jack, of God, nothing less. "And that's what you play for?" "Pretty much." He said he could not refuse to play at least one game in the second ether. After all, they seemed to be trying for the same big win. But he had remained uneasy. Even when Sam Oakenhurst and the Rose began to tell him the stories of the Chaos Engineers, the great epics of quests and revenge which were even now being enacted in the second ether. It seems a little different from a good game of Oglala P, though I can't imagine how it would work out, what moves you'd have to make. What do we lose? "Oh, that's easy too," she said. "I told you, you lose your eternal soul. The demigods of the second ether are not immortal. Their longevity is vast, but ultimately they die. That's why Quelch was so bitter. And if you are not free of them, you die also. The dying demigods become increasingly desperate and greedy for life as they realize what is happening to them. They grow into demons. They prey on the living, their own kind as well as ours. They are death, Jack, determined to overcome life and see the whole multiverse in infinite emptiness, rather than let others have it. It's that simple, Jack." "Well, not simple in the playing, I guess." "I reckon not," she agreed. Now, Jack Caraquazian stood alone by the boat's blunt prow and looked out across the Mississippi River, broad and brown, splashing lazily against the jetties and wharfs, lapping about the useless oil refineries, mile upon mile of them, in untarnished silver alloy, their cryptic slime-traced structures rising from water gradually reclaiming them. To Jack they had a heroic air. What were these plants but the final despairing attempt of their forebears to impose linearity upon an environment which they themselves were increasingly fracturing? White madness, as they used to say. How many billions of people had been infected by it? Jack Caraquazian no longer found the pipelines and storage chambers, the processing systems and personnel sections obscene or grotesque. For him they held a certain nostalgia. What grandiose arrogance. What magnificent confidence in the future they predicted. What vast folly. Mais ce n'est pas la guerre. Chapter 12, Prairie Paddles. Before they got to Natchez, they learned how that city had blazed, her hills lighting up the Louisiana side as bright as day. The border war had lasted 10 weeks before the combatants had united against a fresh enemy from the east and disappeared. Now it was generally reckoned safe along the river, at least as far as Memphis. There was little left to burn. At Mullins, they wooded up and took on passengers, refugees including some Indian women and children who spoke of a massacre of the whites and the Indians with them by an insane army of disinherited petty bourgeois taking its revenge upon familiar victims. But now they had reached Jackson, the Indians had heard, fortifying the city against a rival army marching from Alabama. Quivering paddles pushed the heavy waters up into spray, which passed through the air like little pearls. Each town as far as New Auschwitz was blackened timbers, drifting ash and clinging gritty smoke, so that the dark grey clouds cascading from their own stack seemed pure in comparison. One evening the Indian woman got off at New Auschwitz. They said they had to find relatives. They said they had relatives to find in northern Arkansas, but they feared to get too close to those larger settlements still standing. Cheated of other prey, a mob might turn against them. Cheated of other prey, a mob might again turn on them. "It's the apocalypse," said Jack Caraquazian, watching them stumble through the fouled ruins. "The majority of us revert with terrible ease to the brute state." Murder and rape had become the familiar norm. Doubtless the dinosaurs, too, had trampled decisively towards extinction, preying upon their own kind. He raised a hand to wish the woman a safe journey. They no longer looked back, but doggedly rolled their hand carts up the old trail, joining the Vega de Tennessee, which led into those beautiful blue pine hills where he and Glenda De Vero had spent a day or two long ago. As anger filled him, he could only curse his own folly in letting his lunatic notions of honour separate him from his soul's mate. "It's slower there, Jack," Kalinda had said. "There's more time, and they can reach agreements." "She told me it was just good luck got her to what you call the second ether." Mr. Caraquazian addressed the rose as she joined him at the gangplank. "But I told her I was of an earning disposition. I couldn't take anything that was free." "You got your luck free, Jack." "Yeah, I didn't know that then. I should have imitated her generosity. Those burgers were on my conscience. I guess I've discovered humility. It's of little use now. I'm still separated from a woman I would kill to be near, to protect in any way she so desired." He would no more think to impose upon her love than he would to play a marked deck. His feeling for her surpassed even his sense of honour. His code had been his weakness. It had betrayed them both. It had divided them. He heard her name in the soft wind blowing between the running lines. The wind slammed shut the wooden door of the wheelhouse. Texas. From somewhere below, he was sure he heard a passenger murmur, "Kalinda," and then laughed. But he knew this must be an illusion. When he found her, would she still want him? He had changed. He could not recall the message she had sent, but he remembered his own sentiments. "When death comes, I want to be on the river." It's simple enough. The rose was patient when he asked if Kalinda De Vero still loved him. "She's waiting, Jack. Yet you continually question her motives. Examine her reasons and objectives, forgetting that simple truth. Do you question your luck? She loves you, Jack. She probably doesn't even want to. Kalinda's love for you is direct and uncomplicated, as enduring as your own, and never earned, Jack. Accept it as innocently as you offer yours, and you will thrive in the second ether, Mon Brave." She stood beside him on the upper deck. The cool evening air was warmed by two black stacks which sent whispering wood smoke into the surrounding landscape. Truth and honesty are tested and proven and tempered in the second ether, Jack. In your world, all is entropy. The lie is almost your only currency. Principle is martyred, raped, perverted. The truth is a dilute of uncertain memories. Well, you speak as if our dilemma here were a moral one. What morality has the Biloxi fault? Everything is a fragment of something else, a model for the whole. One thing echoes another. One thing mirrors another. There's a morality to nature, Jack. One we learn to recognize and sometimes emulate. Like recognizes like. That's what you know already, Jack, or you wouldn't be a Yugador. You know the odds, the coincidences, the paradoxes, the repetitions, which a true gambler senses and manipulates. Only the finest adepts can play the game of time with any hope of retaining and amplifying their own identities. With every game you play, you increasingly become your own man. You are daring to change God's plan. We are God's plan, Jack. We believe that if we can bend time, we will have altered the nature of reality. Altered the nature of reality, and you create any multiverse obeying any laws you choose. A multiverse wholly benign to our kind, where death is banished. Jack Caraquazian was in no doubt of his opinion and spoke his mind. You were mad and maybe damned. Perhaps, but we are not the only people devoting our existence to this search. Others seek a return to their origins so that they might influence natural law. Any one theory or all of them will prove practical. Perhaps this race to seek our origins is common amongst sentient species. Perhaps the laws have already been changed many times. Perhaps the paradoxes and impossibilities we find in our worlds are merely fragments of a previous reality. Perhaps we are wrong and the multiverse is, after all, infinite. Perhaps the scales we know are only tiny motes in some vaster multiverse. Well, this is babbling folly, mere visionary abstraction, Rose. Madness is when you set yourself against infinity and inevitability. We believe we are not mad, because we set ourselves against only quasi-infinity. Nature is finite. If the smallest fragment reflects the whole, then death is inevitable for the multiverse. But by the same logic, rebirth is also inevitable. We wish to be present at that precise moment between the death of the old multiverse and the beginnings of the new. I have no such long view of things, says Jack. In a world of reflections, there are no evident causes, only effects. You stand in a hall of mirrors trying to determine which image was the original, yet they are perfectly reproduced. Is it the smallest or the largest? How can you tell? You have dispensed with all measurement, and therefore with all morality. Not so. The answer is to create what you seek. You triumph over nature by winning at the game. Every time you beat the odds, Jack, you add further substance to your own individuality. Ultimately, you will resemble nothing but yourself, yet you will recognize others like you. Self-discipline and self-knowledge are the key. An individual becomes a unique universe, able to move at will through all the scales of the multiverse, potentially able to control the immediate reality of every scale, every encountered environment. She looked up at the darkening sky. We are magicians and ghosts, Jack. We are goblins and visitations. We are future and past. We are memory and we are forgetfulness. Yet we achieve a kind of psychic density, so that we remain coherent as we travel up and down the scales, back and forth across the multiverse, walking between the worlds on the silver roads people call moonbeams. Our existence is deeply dependent upon individual responsibility and will. That which our group conscience understands to be evil is evil. Well, this is blasphemous arrogance, says Jack Caraquazian without dismay, smiling. This is ungodly Satanism, but he is curious. No, Jack, we are fulfilling the will of our kind, and therefore the will of God. Consider, for instance, the intellectual rigour required, the careful debate between the wise thinkers of the day, the understanding of human nature, the willingness to listen to the testament of simple people, the ordering and reordering required before those elders eventually codified the Ten Commandments. And if you believe those commandments came from God, so be it, for I believe God to be the sum of all that is humane in us, all that is logical, and all that is, if you like, divine. But if God did give us the Ten Commandments through a revelation, I think that's supposed to be revelation, to Moses, what an intellect God must have. And if we fail to respect such a mighty intellect, we are fools. The world is full of more wisdom than destructive ignorance. Why then do we let our society simplify and devolve? Look how we are reduced to warring tribes. How readily we offer up our own freedom to those who would destroy entire worlds for their immediate self-gratification. Why can't that vast majority of us band together to achieve peace and equity? What are we fighting, Jack, that has the power to conquer the will of almost every sentient creature in the multiverse? You speak of the original insect. It was growing cool. Down at the waterline, the Whitey Stokers had come up for a breath of air and were staring with intense concentration into creamy water, stirred by slow paddles, as if they divined their fate there. I speak of that life which is deadly, which exists only to devour and breed, yes, and which we define as the original insect, inimical to our kind. It would reduce all life and thought to a few primitive functions, forever frozen in its development, thus achieving a kind of semi-immortality. But that is only death refusing the name, eh? Doubtless, says Jax, turning up his jacket collar. You make our opponents seem unbeatable, Rose. You have the means of beating them, Jack, should you ever wish to play. Well, he chided her for this. Both he and she already knew he was irredeemably destined to play the game of time. I have a habit of cool-headedness, that's all, said Mr. Caraquazan. A certain talent with the flat tables. A firm belief that God enjoys a roll or two of the dice now and again. And a strong sense of what should be, she added. She began to laugh at his mystification and who you are. She enjoyed walking away from him, leaving him to watch the Indian woman descend a hill and disappear. Tomorrow, La Perle du Suede would push past Memphis. She had been warned not to stop in that wretched ruin.